Hi, I'm Ken Tangent. This is episode 25 of What's It Like? My guest is John Glore, playwright. How do you make a living as a playwright?
Well, I don't really. I have a very good day job in the theater as the Associate Artistic Director at South Coast Rep, so that's what I spend most of my time doing, and when I can grab a little time for myself, then I work on my playwriting projects on the side.
Is anybody really making a living at playwriting?
Oh, there are a few around the country. You know, there's that old saying, you can make a killing in the theater, but you can't make a living, and it's kind of true for playwrights as well as other theater practitioners, but particularly... There are ways you can sort of supplement your income from the plays themselves and still feel as though you're doing your chosen vocation,
mm-hmm.
teaching being one of those things, or writing for film and television,
right.
which used to be considered a kind of, you know, mercenary pursuit for a serious playwright, but not anymore. Now there are some really wonderful shows on TV that give a lot of artistic satisfaction to playwrights. And obviously, if you can sell a movie, there are ways to get a lot of artistic gratification from that as well.
One of the best things about being a playwright seems to me to be that going to parties and they say, "What do you do?" And you say, "I'm a playwright."
Uh huh.
Which is usually followed by, "What have you written?"
Exactly. Yeah. And then they're disappointed when they've never heard of whatever it is you
yes.
tell them. Yeah.
So historically, playwrights have their words have been unchangeable by the theater. Is that still the case, or has there been shifts in that?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the reasons why some writers still want to keep their hand in the theater as opposed to film and television, because the writer isn't respected as much in those other media. The director is really king or queen in those media. But in the theater, it's understood that when you produce a play, you produce it as it was written, or if you are interested in changes, they have to be approved by the writer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's absolutely true when you're dealing with work that is still under copyright and protected by those regulations. When you're talking about a classic, something by Shakespeare or written, you know, prior to the 20th century, then directors feel a little bit more free to shape the text according to their needs for their production. So Shakespeare plays often get cut because they're so long. You rewrite them at your peril, but you can trim them.
What did you want to be when you were growing up?
You know, I didn't ever really have a kind of vocation as I was growing up. I actually, in junior high and high school, my strong suits were math and science. So I actually went off to college thinking that one of those two was going to become my profession in some way or another. But after a year of college-level math and physics, I decided that really wasn't my calling after all. So at that point, I started looking around for other possibilities. I had been doing theater in one way or another for a few years, you know, just as on the side. I didn't take classes, but I did a couple of shows in high school, and I did begin taking theater classes when I got to college, and that became more and more interesting to me. But I was also always interested in literature and in writing. And so my college major ended up being an interdisciplinary major in theater and literature. And that sort of led me toward the profession that I pursue when I'm not writing plays, which is dramaturgy, which is sort of the literary expert within the theater.
Where did you go to college?
Went to Reed College in Portland, Oregon.
Ah, how liberal of you. Aren't they the college that gives liberal arts the liberal name?
Yeah, I think so. That's its reputation anyway.
Did you grow up in Oregon?
No. No, I grew up in a military family, so I moved around a lot as a kid. Spent a lot of time in the Washington, D.C. area. And when I started looking at colleges, my grandfather actually knew about Reed and took me to visit it, and I kind of fell in love with it. So that's how I ended up there.
Yeah, it's a great school. How did your parents impact your worldview? Aside from dragging you around the world.
Yeah, well, actually, that had a huge impact. The fact that my dad was a career military officer meant that I was picking up and moving every 3 years or so and having to make new friends and sort of figure out a new environment. And so I think that probably had an effect on my personality and on my worldview. It remains difficult for me to hold on to friends once they're out of sight and out of mind, you know. I don't have really any lifelong friends anymore.
Hmm.
Never really did, actually. I make new friends wherever I am, and then I keep those as long as I can. So, you know, I've got a group of friends now that have been my friends for 25, almost 30 years, which is how long I've lived in Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
My parents are both sort of liberal-minded politically, so that certainly influenced me because I consider myself to be a liberal as well. My mother is pretty religious, and I'm not, so she didn't influence me in that way. Although as I was growing up, I was exposed I went to church regularly and was exposed to religious doctrine, which actually I value now, even though I don't consider myself religious anymore. It's very useful for me to be well-grounded in kind of the mythology of Judeo-Christian religions, because they are called upon so often in literary works. So it's great to be able to know what I'm reading about when I read references that derive from Judeo-Christian belief.
So lots of themes to follow.
Yeah.
If you hadn't become a playwright, what would you have become?
I don't know. I mean, in a sense, I never became a playwright fully, as I said. It's always been more of a side pursuit for me. If I weren't involved in the literary side of theater, I'm not really sure what I would be doing now. Perhaps I would have found my way back towards some kind of science oriented career, because I remain very interested in science as just something to read avocationally. But I also, I don't really know why, but I've always had a strong interest in something that would involve working with my hands, carpentry or something like that, furniture carpentry. My uncle on my mother's side did that kind of work as a young man, and I think I was fascinated by it. And I just like the idea of making something out of nothing with your hands. So I have ended up being something like that. I don't have time to do that stuff now. But I admire people who can do that.
Now that you've survived childhood, what constitutes family for you now?
Well, I have a wife and a daughter of my own. My daughter went off to college this year. She's a freshman at University of Chicago. That's sort of my immediate family. And my two dogs and my cat are part of the family as well.
So what's it like to have your daughter go off to college?
You know, it was traumatic initially, but I adjusted to it more quickly than I thought I might.
Out of sight, out of mind?
Well, yeah, to some extent. And also I think that in contemporary society makes it easier to face that eventuality as a parent, because in America, at least, your teenagers are out of sight, out of mind, pretty much from the time they become teenagers. They go into their bedrooms, they close the door, they sit at their computers or talk on their phones or text on their phones. And you don't see that much of them on a regular basis. So in a sense, I was already kind of used to Josie not being a constant presence in my life. And so now, when she's off in college, in some ways I talk to her more than I did when she was living in my house.
Mm-hmm.
And Skype with her, it's a lot easier to communicate with your college-bound kids now than it was when I was in college, because there are so many options between cell phones and computer, email and texting and Skyping and all of that stuff.
Yeah. So what do you actually do?
My title at South Coast Now is Associate Artistic Director. I sort of made my way up the totem pole a little bit. So I'm involved in various activities here at the theater, including producing. I kind of oversee the Theater for Young Audiences program here, and I co-direct the Pacific Playwrights Festival, which is a big annual play development event that we do.
Mm-hmm.
And year-round, I'm constantly working with other playwrights on their work. A dramaturg, at least when it comes to working on new plays, is sort of like an editor, in the way that an editor would work with a novelist to try to guide a novelist to the best iteration of his or her creative work.
A cross between an editor and a mentor?
Sometimes I'm acting as a mentor, but sometimes I'm working with someone who I consider to be my peer. So I wouldn't consider myself a mentor in that situation, but definitely an editor or a facilitator, a creative facilitator. Sometimes you got to be a little bit of a shrink in terms of asking the right questions that will help draw out the best work from that writer. And then, I do various kinds of writing in my job as well, program notes and grant writing and copywriting for the marketing and publicity that we do for our work.
What's the best thing about your job?
I guess I would have to say it's the variety. You know, I'm constantly moving from one project to another, so it's pretty hard to get bored. I can be working on a workshop of a brand new play with the playwright in attendance 1 week, and then I can be working on a Shakespeare play the next week, and then I can be having producerial oversight of a new play for kids or a classic play for kids. And then occasionally my two lives overlap so that I will, for instance, a year or so ago, I wrote an adaptation of A Wrinkle in Time specifically to produce it in our Young Audiences series here. It's a book that I loved as a kid and then kind of became reacquainted with when my daughter was growing up. And I thought that it would be a great show to do here, but I couldn't find an adaptation that I really liked. So I decided I'd do one myself. So if you can see, there's a lot of variety in what I do and a lot of creative fulfillment as well.
What a surprise to you.
I don't know that it's surprised me, but there's been a definite trend over the last 10 to 15 years that has seen a fall off in interest in subscribing to the theater programming. When South Coast was in its heyday back in the 80s and 90s, we had upwards of 25,000 subscribers for our two theaters, which meant that the theaters were filled to approximately 75% of capacity before we ever sold a single ticket, you know, just by means of subscribers. Nowadays, we're well below 50% subscribed, and the trend is continuing in that direction. I think it's just a sign of the times that the generation that supported us in our heyday has aged to the point where they some of them have actually, you know, died or gotten old enough that they can't get out of the house easily anymore. So they've stopped subscribing, and they're not being replaced by younger generations because it's not part of the culture anymore. And there are many reasons for that, including the fact that there's been really, you know, in the state of California and nationwide, arts education has been terribly underfunded and has not been a priority in the schools. So people growing up aren't yet being exposed to theater the way they once were, or not to mention the other arts. In any case, whatever the reasons, people are less interested in subscribing anymore, which means it's much harder to fill our seats, and we have to do it by selling, you know, one seat at a time for one show at a time, and it means we don't have that nice cushion of money in the bank at the beginning of the season that you get when you sell subscriptions. So I've been seeing my profession change in response to that. We have to change the way we do business, and to some extent we have to change our thinking about how we program the theater.
Does that push the theater to more commercial work?
For some theaters it has. I wouldn't say that's true at South Coast Rep. This theater is so devoted to new plays, and new plays are by definition not commercial because they're the hardest thing to sell. People don't know the title, so you have to convince them. You have to give them a reason to come see it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it may have slightly altered the balance here in terms of new plays versus classics. If we know we're going to have a certain number of new plays in the mix, then we have to make sure we have some really well-known classic titles that will help draw people in and sell however many subscriptions we might be able to sell. And we're also having to figure out how to adjust to the very real competition we get from so many other media, you know, that have exploded into the culture in the last 10 to 20 years, and how we can take advantage of those media to help, you know, promote our own work. So we're on Twitter now, we're on Facebook, we're on MySpace, and we're looking at ways to appeal to young generations who are completely plugged into all of that kind of social media, and try to convince them that the old-fashioned medium of theater is still worth their time and interest.
I got some more questions for John, but first let me remind you of the good work done by the ALS Association when it was founded in 1985. I'd never really heard of amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. I'd heard of Lou Gehrig, the baseball player, and that he had some kind of disease, but he was way before my time. And I knew the actor David Niven had the disease. But when my mom was diagnosed with ALS in 1987 and died from it the following year, then I paid attention. This is a terrible disease. It's not contagious, but it is progressive. It's a neuromuscular disorder that gradually kills you. Your brain is connected to your muscles by motor neurons. In ALS, the muscles work fine, or at least they would if they receive signals from the brain. But the motor neurons that carry the instructions die off. No signals, no movement. No movement, no strength, and finally no breathing. So it's important to figure out how these motor neurons work and how to keep them alive. If you want to become a researcher, here's an interesting area to pursue. And if research isn't your thing, but you want to help, go to ALSA.org and donate to the ALS Association. Your help would be greatly appreciated. So, John, everyone has to give themselves self-motivation occasionally. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
Well, I'm really bad at that, actually. I don't need to do it in terms of my job at South Coast Rep, but as a playwright, I have poor discipline, and it's very easy for me to not write. And so I look for ways to create external stimulus to get myself to write. For instance, I mentioned earlier that I wrote this adaptation of A Wrinkle in Time. I pitched it to the artistic directors of the theater here before I had written a word. I said, I want to write this adaptation, and I want to produce it next season, and I want you to sign off on that. And they trust me enough that they did, with some provisions. And it meant I had a hard deadline by which I had to have a play ready. And that forced me to adopt the kind of discipline that I don't normally have. So I would spend my weekends working on the script instead of goofing around and working crossword puzzles and, you know, playing with the dogs or what have you. I would, you know, chain myself to my computer and churn out as many pages as I could, and also in evenings. And I got it done, and I got it done in plenty of time to allow it to have the kind of development that it would need to be ready for production. So that sort of thing is always useful for me to sort of impose discipline on myself. I've occasionally used playwriting competitions, which have their own deadlines, as a way to do that as well.
Let me turn the question around. How do you, when you need to soothe yourself, how do you calm yourself down?
Well, a martini always helps. various ways. You know, I typically avoid taking work home with me, SCR work home with me. So when I get home, I can relax and play with the dogs and watch a basketball game on television or a baseball game. I now ride a bicycle as a form of exercise. I've been doing that for the last half year or so, and I find that to be very calming, not to mention healthy for me. So I've got various ways that I can do that. I'm a pretty calm person by nature.
Yes. Is there an event in your life that has challenged you to the core?
The one that I will talk about, it's not an event so much, but a reality of my life, is that I have a brother, an older brother, the firstborn in my family, who was born with severe brain damage and as a result was never acquired language, isn't really able to take care of himself. And he was a constant presence in my childhood, something that made it hard for me to bring friends to the house because I was embarrassed about his presence in the family. It also obviously meant that my parents had to be focused on him a lot and a little bit less on the rest of us in the family. So his being in the family, I think, deeply affected me, and I'm sure affected how my personality evolved as I grew up. And so, yeah.
How much older was he than you?
He's a little less than 2 years older than
me. That's pretty close.
And he did actually. My parents finally found a situation for him where my mother never considered putting him in an institution. That was never on the table. But he began working in a shelter for developmentally disabled people. So he had a little job that he went to every day. And then eventually they found a group home for him to be part of, because my parents are getting up in age now, and they wanted to make sure he was situated somewhere so he could be well provided for, and that the siblings wouldn't have to worry about that. So he's been living in that home now for, I don't even know how long, 10, 15 years, and actually is thriving there. It was never a problem for him to adjust, mm-hmm. not living at home anymore.
My little brother had Down syndrome, but severe brain damage as well, and was unable to, it was like a baby. Uh-huh. And never progressed beyond that stage, and he lived for 7 years. So he was in many ways a family project, But he was 10 years younger than I was. And that age difference, I think, is critical.
Yeah, definitely.
My last question is to help me get better at this. If you think of a defining moment or a story in your life that we haven't talked about, what question should I have asked you to tell me that story?
I don't know if I can think of anything. You may have covered the bases pretty well.
I have a friend who asks, what moment in your childhood most defines you as an adult now?
I feel like I sort of covered that. It was not an event, but the fact of my brother, and also the fact of being in a military family and moving around all the time. I think those are the two things that had the biggest influence on who I am as an adult now.
Yeah.
And then the third thing is something that happened when I was already an adult and had been for quite a while, which is the birth of my child. She was born when I was 36. So I had been able to pretend I was young and footloose and fancy free for most of the first four decades of my life. But once she came along, then, you know, everything changes.
Yes.
She becomes the focus of everything you do. And so that changed me too.
Well, let me ask you this. If you're giving a commencement address, high school or college graduation, giving your best advice, what would you say?
Well, it's a cliche, but I really believe it to be true, which is to follow your bliss, follow your dreams. I did, and I never allowed myself to worry about the fact that you can't make a living in the theater, and as a result, I have made a living in the theater for my entire adult life. And not everyone is as lucky as I am, but I think that if you have any hope of being happy through your adult life, you need to be doing something that you find fulfilling and rewarding and fun. And I've done that, and I've never regretted it. I've never had a reason to regret it, really. And so as my daughter is going into college and starting to think about careers and starting to think about things like theater and film, I jokingly say, no, don't go into film. But she knows that I'm joking, and that if that's what she decides she wants to do, she's going to have my full support, because I had my parents' full support. Mm-hmm. It's sort of remarkable to me that a father who was a military man didn't bat an eye when I told him I want to major in theater and try to do my life's work in theater. And my mother, who never went to the theater, neither of them went to the theater, also fully supported me. And now they go to the theater all the time. So so that's really it. It's just, don't do what you think you have to do. Do what you feel like you must do or want to do, and follow that as religiously as you can.
What do you tell people who say, I want to become a playwright?
Well, first of all, I ask them, are they sure? Because it's not something you can sort of blithely enter into. It's just the reality that it's almost impossible to survive, let alone thrive, on what you make as a playwright. So you have to know going into it that it's the only thing you can do. And you have to be driven to do it, because you're going to have to face a lot of adversity, even if you're good at it. It's going to take a long time for you to establish yourself. You're going to have a lot of lean years. You're going to have a lot of years where you're having to do something else to pay the rent while you write, in the evenings or late at night. And it's incredibly frustrating, because no matter how good you are, you're going to end up writing a lot of stuff that never sees the light of day. And plays are written to be performed. They are community artwork. And so as you write play after play after play that goes into a drawer, you're having to say to yourself, these plays are stillborn. They will never be what they were intended to be until I become famous, and then I can pull them out of the drawer and someone will want to produce them. But in the meantime, there they are in the drawer gathering dust, until you finally write the one that catches the right person's eye. And then maybe, if you're lucky, you get a little kickstart to your career. So anyone who tells me they want to be a playwright, that's, I just try to be realistic with them about it. Say, don't do it unless it's the only thing you can do. Same is true of an actor or any career in the theater. You have to know that's what you have to do.
Mm-hmm. When I'm writing a play, I see it being performed. Do you have a particular way of viewing it?
Well, I do that as well, and it comes naturally to me, because my job at South Coast is focused mainly on reading other people's plays, and I have to do the same thing then. I have to be able to sort of imagine what they would look like in three dimensions with designs and lighting and costumes and all of that stuff. So it's sort of automatic with me, whether I'm reading a play or writing it, to kind of imagine it in three dimensions.
It's like writing sculpture.
Right, exactly.
Well, I want to thank John Glure for joining me today. Thanks, John. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.